Okay, so last time we looked at this sort of different view of molecules as computers see them, to look at the molecular orbitals that computers calculate, which is probably realistic as well, to the extent that orbitals themselves are real when they don't explicitly take into account electron-electron repulsion. So, and we saw that these orbitals, like any orbitals, are controlled by their shape is controlled by a balance of kinetic and potential energy. The kinetic energy is the same thing that you see in a single atom, and you see nodal patterns much the same way, although they're distorted by the positions of the fragments, you might say, of the nucleus that's broken up to give the nuclei of a bunch of different atoms. And just for one last rehearsal through this, we could look at a molecule that has almost no symmetry at all, 1-fluoroethanol, a molecule which in fact is not stable, but still the computer is able to calculate wave functions for it. That is, it's stable in the sense that it's an energy minimum, that it would vibrate, not just fly apart, but it's very reactive. It could easily lose HCl or HF. Okay, so anyhow, there are the positions of the nuclei, which is what you present to the computer program, and then it can adjust the position slightly in order to minimize the overall energy, which is its goal. So we look at the lowest possible orbital, and it's a 1s orbital on which atom? Fluorine. Why on fluorine? Why? Yeah? Yeah, it's like why, was it Lucky Luciano or anybody robbed banks? Because that's where the money is, right? This is where the protons are, so that's where the electrons prefer to go. Where do you think the next orbital is? The next highest energy? On oxygen, because it has the next most electrons. And next? There are two carbons. Both carbons? Brian? Why the far right? So if the carbon, why do you say the carbon on the left is more positive? Okay, so there's this persistent idea of electronegativity. That's not Coulomb's law, it's not gravity. We might wonder what exactly electronegativity is, and we'll get to that later on and find that there's not quite as much there as you might think. But at any rate, we know that other atoms tend to attract electrons to themselves empirically. We've heard it told about a lot. So the carbon on the left indeed has less electron density than the one on the right. That is, the electrons tend to be drawn away from it. Now, what does that mean about where the lowest energy is going to be? If one of the carbons has fewer electrons around it, would other electrons prefer to be there or to be elsewhere? No. The fewer electrons there are someplace, the more other electrons would like to be there. They're being repelled by it, right? So indeed, the next one is the carbon that has the electronegative groups on it, right? And finally, that carbon, okay? And now we begin, these are the uninteresting orbitals, the core orbitals, which for practical purposes we could pretend are part of the nucleus, right? And now we look at the interesting ones, the valence level orbitals. So the first valence level orbital is going to be an S orbital, which in an atom would be a sphere. But in this case, how is it going to be distorted? Where is it going to be mostly? Sharif?
I think it's going to be distorted to the left.
Straight to the left, up to the left, down to the left?
Down to the left.
Why?
Because of the fluorine there.
Because the fluorine's got so many protons. Yep, indeed you're right. Although there's a little bit of the others in it too. Okay, so it's a little bit more like a sphere over the whole molecule than if it were just around the fluorine. And next, what's the next orbital going to be? See if you can guess. So we've got the S orbital. What's going to come next? A P orbital. Okay, and it is mostly on the oxygen, not on the fluorine. Why is it distorted in that direction? Will? fluorine has more protons, so wouldn't it rather be down there, the electron? Any ideas? Victor?
Previous electrons have been there already.
So. Yeah, there are electrons there already in the previous orbital. They're repelling this electron, so it goes to the top. If the ones go to the bottom, this one goes to the top. That bottom orbital has been used up, mostly, in housing the previous one, so it goes to the top. Okay, now, and here's the 2PY orbital, which, if we rotate the molecule around a horizontal axis, you can see a little bit more clearly. Okay? And when it's rotated like that, we can see the third P orbital as well, which looks like that, except it actually looks more like an SP hybrid. Do you see what I mean? Then it looks like a P orbital. It's so distorted. So if you get an SP hybrid, that if you take two atomic orbitals and mix them, like S and P, you still have some S and some P left over, right? And you can mix those again to make another, a second SP hybrid. I bet you knew that already. But it'll point the other way, right? So the next one is the one that points down. Okay? And then there's this one, which you can see is a D orbital, distorted to be where the protons are. Okay? Some of the orbitals aren't as easily recognized as this, but the general idea that you could start with an atomic orbital with all the protons in the middle and then start pulling them out slowly and watching the shape change. Every orbital that you start with will change into one of these molecular orbitals, and we can see clearly how some of them would change. Okay, so the purpose of showing this is to show that the same principles apply in molecules and molecular orbitals as apply in atoms and atomic orbitals, and the same problems arise with respect to electron correlation. So in this plum pudding view of molecular orbitals, you see the generality of kinetic energy-based clouds of electrons in which the nuclei are embedded. So this is the single united atom, as it's sometimes called, picture. But we could use other contours, and the one we're going to focus on for the rest of the course, really, is the one, this contour, which shows atoms weakly bonded. That is this 5% of electron density that we saw experimentally builds up between atoms to hold them together, that we saw in X-ray difference density maps. Okay, now, the true molecular orbitals, if you regard the ones that are solutions to Schrödinger's equation, or the ones that that you calculate with a big computer, go over the whole molecule, as we've just been seeing. But we want to divide the pi differently into little localized bits of electron density, which we will consider bonds, so that we'll look at locally rather than globally at the electron distribution in the molecule. So we want pairwise LCAOMOs. Now that's an acronym, of course. And what it means is that you add atomic orbitals, like the atomic orbital of nucleus A and the atomic orbital of nucleus B, and you get something when you add that has values here around A, here around B, here in the middle. In fact, it has values everywhere, but the big values are there. Okay? And so this is a sum, and a sum is, for people who are sophisticated in mathematics, called a linear combination, in part because you could vary the amount you use. You could have more of this one and less of this one, or more of this one and less of this one. So a linear combination of atomic orbitals to make an MO, a molecular orbital, actually not one of these that goes over the whole molecule, but just a localized, pairwise molecular orbital. So this adding of orbitals to make new orbitals is just like hybridization. Remember, we added an S and a P orbital together on an atom to make the electrons shift one direction? Except that here, the orbitals we're adding are not on the same atom. They're on different atoms. Okay. Sharif?
But then what does that mean? We can only do it with one electron again?
Well, there can be two electrons in any orbital, because they have opposite spin, which we're not talking about. That's called the Pauli principle, and I'm not defending it. It's just what's observed in nature. You can get two to an orbital, maximum.
Okay.
Two electrons. Two electrons can be described by the same probability distribution, although you know that if they were described by the same one, they'd tend to stay apart from one another. When one of them is on A, the other one would tend to be on B, and vice versa, because they repel one another. Okay, now, why is it sensible to think that we might be able to write molecular orbitals as sums of atomic orbitals this way? Well, let's see, let's consider two hydrogen atoms. Actually, just have it be one electron, although we could use two, as Sharif points out. But suppose the nuclei are very far apart, like 2 meters apart, right? A long way. Now, I'm interested in what the electron density is going to be if I have a proton here, and one electron. Okay, what do you think? Where do you think the electron's going to be? Is it going to be most likely halfway in between, you think? Why not, Sinead? It's not because they're too far apart. Well, in a sense it is. It's because the electron is too far from them. That's going to be very high potential energy to be half a meter away from a proton. Much better to be on the proton. So what should the wave function look like? The density distribution. Yeah. Okay, it should sometimes be on this A and sometimes on the B. Probably half the time each one if they're two protons and symmetrical. Right? It would take a long time to get back and forth. The tunnel, it's a double minimum problem, right? And the tunneling rate would be really, really slow because there's probably the life of the universe is not long enough for the electron to jump from here to here at normal temperature, right, in the lowest energy level. But in principle, if we waited long enough, it would spend half its time here and half its time here. So we could write what the electron density is going to look like. Half the time it's going to look exactly like this atom because this one is so far away. Half the time it's going to look exactly like this atom. But we know exactly what this electron density looks like. And we know what this one looks like because we know the atomic orbitals. Right? So this is what the electron density should look like. It's a function of the position of one electron, but there are two nuclei, A and B. So we have an atomic orbital on A, we square that, that's the density when it's around A, and the density when it's around B is the atomic orbital B squared, and we take a half because it's spending half of its time each place. Is that clear to everyone? Henry?
No, not quite, because our psi function produces a
minus. Because what I can...
Our psi function... AO
of
A plus AO of B. If you square that, we should have a
2AO AB. No, this is I'm showing the density, the square. This is what the density should look like. That's where I'm starting from. That AOA squared is the electron density when it's on A. AOB squared is the density when it's on B. If I take half of each, that says it's half the time looking like A, half the time looking like B. No problem. Now, that's the electron density, right? What's the wave function look like? Well, we have its square. All we have to do is take the square root, and we have the wave function. There it is. Okay? Nothing could be simpler. We know what the square has to look like. So we take the square root, and that's our value. That's our wave function. Easy. What's that, Dre? Oh. So you're worried about that. Now the question is that an error? Is that something to worry about? How big is that error? Okay. So here we have the two protons that are a meter apart. Okay, now, what's the value of... Here's A, let's say, okay? And it has a wave function that's this exponential kind of thing. Right, the 1s looks like that. What is its value here? What's its value here? Practically. Zero. I mean, it's not zero, but boy, is it ever small a meter away. Okay? Now, B has a big value there. The atomic orbital of B has a big value. How about the product, A times B? Is it big? Is A times B a big number? It's zero because A is zero there. Over here, B is zero. How about halfway between? Is that going to give us a problem? It's half a meter from each of them. Is that a problem, A times B? No, everywhere you go, this value is essentially zero. So we, although in principle we've made an error, as a practical matter we haven't made an error because the value is zero everywhere, practically zero. So we did it right. We took the correct square root. Isn't that neat? Except what? What happened? We're not really interested in two protons that are a meter apart. We're interested in two protons that are more like an angstrom apart. Now maybe we have trouble. Okay, so no, that wasn't a great distance. Now, it was negligible. So now how about if we're at bonding distance? Now that's going to crop back up again. So what kind of error is it going to cause? Okay, so suppose we go ahead and approximate the molecular orbital by this pseudo square root which we've drawn. And now I just write A to mean the atomic orbital of A and B an atomic orbital on B. And why do I put 1 over the square root of 2 there? So when it squares up, it'll become a half, which means it's half of A squared and half of B squared. That's where we were coming from. Okay, so that's it. Now, it looks very good near the nuclei. Near A, it looks exactly like A. Near B, it looks exactly like B. And we square that to find the electron density, and there's this extra term in there, 2AB times a half. That is, A times B is the extra term. But now let's see how different it is from just two atoms. So let's subtract from the electron density we got from our trial wave function. Let's subtract the atoms, right? And what we get is A times B. But you know that's what you get experimentally too. You get electron density different from what's in the atoms. Right? So this is exactly what we saw experimentally, that there's electron density that shifts. Let's look at about this. So this is a byproduct from squaring a sum. Right? When we squared a sum, we got this cross term. Right? So it was just a byproduct at first. Incidentally, it is a product. So that's another place where you multiply wave functions when you square them. Okay, but it's a completely different instance of multiplying. It's not like the two-electron wave function we drew before. Okay, now, that means that we've got extra electron density. So what we're going to have to do is make it a little less than 1 over the square root of 2, enough so the total is going to be 1 when we sum over everywhere. Everybody with us on that, when you square a half a plus b, you're going to get half a squared plus b squared, which is going to integrate to 1, all because a squared is 1 and b squared is 1, so half their sum is going to be 1. But you have a little bit more, so you're going to have to make it a little bit less than 1 over the square root of 2 in order to normalize it. Sonny?
Why you have to subtract the average?
I can't, what?
I don't understand why you have to subtract the average.
Because if it's H2 we're talking about and it's symmetrical, when they're far apart, clearly it's half this and half this, right? So that's a half times their sum. In a sense, that's their average. Okay? Okay, so what does this mean, though? The fact that that's less than a half, it means that you're shifting electrons, which if it were the atom, if it were just the atoms, these bottom things, you'd have this much electron density on A and on B. Now you have a little bit less than a half of A squared plus B squared. So you've shifted electron density away from the atoms in doing that, in making that less than 1 over the square root of 2. And where did the electron density go that you took away from the atoms? It went to wherever this AB thing is. Right, so it shifts from the atoms to this region where the product has a significant value. Some places the product, like 10 meters out there, the product has no value. Right, but some places that product is going to have a value, and that's where the electrons are going to build up. Aviva?
What is that a product of?
It's A is a function. Right? It's an atomic orbital like 1s. It has a value here, a value here, a value here, a value here. B is the same, let's say, atomic function, 1s, but it's measured from B. Right? So it has values here, values here, values here, values. So at any given point, like here, A has a value, B has a value. The product of those is A times B. It's just a product of those two values that the two functions assign to that position for the electron. Okay, so that's where the electron density went. Now, and this, then this, I'm asserting that this overlap, the term that we thought was an error, is in fact what makes a bond. Right? That's the shift of electrons that we observed by X-ray diffraction. And we've seen the same kind of thing from in when we were doing one-dimensional quantum mechanics. But just schematically, this is this. We have an A function and a B function, two different minima. And if they're far apart, you get a wave function that looks like that. And if you bring them close together, they overlap, and the square builds up in the middle. Right? And that stabilizes the particle. And it's also, we talked, emphasized before, that it's stabilized because the kinetic energy goes down, because the curvature is less. But the electron density grows in the middle. But if you add those two with an opposite sign, so that's bonding. If you add with an opposite sign, now you have zero electron density in the middle. You've taken electron density out of the middle and put it on the atoms. Right? The electron density shrinks there, and we call that, as we said before, an antibond. Now we're taking more of the point of view of potential energy, whereas before we discussed this in terms of kinetic energy. Okay, now let's see where that overlap term is big. So there's a 1s orbital squared. So that's the electron density on A. Where is psi A squared significant? Where is the density significant? How about there? Significant or no? No. How about there? Yeah. Okay, how about over here? A little less, but it's significant, but certainly less than the other one. Now let's put B there too. So now, Aviva, we have these two functions, A and B, right? And now we want to see a different thing. We want to see where A times B is significant. So Aviva, since this is your specialty, you're going to help us. Okay, is A times B important there? No, A is small out there, B is small out there, A times B is nothing. Okay? No. How about here, Aviva? Why do you shake your head? Can't hear.
It's really far from B.
Right. A is still significant there, but B is practically zero. So A times B is nothing there. But how about this third place that we talked about? Ah, now we've hit it, right? Because both A and B are at least a little significant there, so their product is something to talk about. So there's the point we're interested in. This is the region of overlap. At the exact center between the two, notice that 2AB is as large as A squared plus B squared. See what I mean? 2AB, if the psi A is equal to psi B halfway between, those two terms are the same size. So in fact, the electron density got almost doubled. Why do I say almost? Why don't I say it's doubled? It looks like it's doubled. It's because we put in that less than 1 over the square root of 2, so it's not quite that big. Okay? That normalization took it down a little bit. So that's the region where there's significant overlap. That's where electron density will build up when we make this function A plus B normalized. Okay? So the overlap integral measures the net change from the atoms. That is, how big is that product? Sum it up all over everywhere. Its big values are only going to be in that region in between. And that's the overlap integral. And the bigger the overlap integral, the more electrons you're going to put in there, the more they're going to serve as glue to hold the atoms together, the stronger the bond will be. Okay? This is really important. If you have a question about it, stop me now. Yeah, Hassan?
In the previous slide, you said that when they multiply each other to zero,
I didn't say it. No, that's when they were a meter apart.
Oh.
Now they're atoms. Now I've shown how close they are, that their waves really do overlap. If I pulled those things are about an angstrom apart. If I made them 10 to the 6th further apart, then there wouldn't be anything in the middle. Although what there is in the middle would be twice as big as what it would be if it were just two atoms superimposed, but it's zero in either case if they're a meter apart. Okay, now, this is a comparison, these next few slides, that was published in Israel Journal of Chemistry about 40 years ago, and at that time the ultimate functions were more or less state of the art. So anyhow, and for H2+, although this is H2 with two electrons, so you're going to have correlation and so on, it was pretty good even at that time. Okay, so we know what psi A and psi B look like. They're e to the minus rho over 2. They look like that. And they overlap in the middle there. Okay? And, I mean, they overlap everywhere, but the overlap is significant in the middle. Right? So we could use that wave function to calculate the total electron density. And having this approximation to the total electron density, which I got easy as pie, right? All I did was take this one function we know, e to the minus distance, the other function, e to the minus distance, measured from a different nucleus, add those two numbers together and square it, and that's what we got here. It had to be normalized. Okay? But now, I have this trial function based on 1s atomic orbitals, adding to a linear combination of orbitals, adding to 1s atomic orbitals, something a little less than 1 over the square root of the 2 times the sum, and I square it, and I get the contours shown on the left. And if I take a difference density by subtracting atoms from that, I see what's on the right. And it's contoured on the left at big steps, and on the right at small steps, because I'm just looking at this fine difference between the two. It looks mostly like two spheres superimposed on the left, but there's a difference, and we see the difference in the difference map, as you know from X-ray. Okay, but what do you see? The electron density at the middle now is 0.02 electrons per cubic angstrom, right? And this crude model calculates 92.9% of the total electron density, right? Of the total electronic energy. So it's a very good estimate, right? More than 90% correct. Just this really, really, really simple function. Yeah.
Is there a node there?
On the right? No. Oh, there's a node in the difference. Because when you take the difference, the total is the same in both maps. So when you take a difference, it's positive in some regions and negative in other regions. And in fact, that's exactly what we'll see here. It's a couple steps along, but you'll see it shortly. Okay, so this is 92.9% of the total electronic energy. But most of that energy was already there in the atoms. It's not the bond. We're interested in how much does the energy go down when it forms a bond. We're interested in the bond strength. So we're not interested in the total energy. We're interested in the change of energy. So if we subtract out the atomic energy to see how much it changed, we're only halfway there in terms of understanding the bond energy. Is everybody clear on the difference between the total energy and the bond energy? Right? You take electrons, you put them on protons and make two hydrogen atoms. You get a lot of energy out of that. Now you take the two hydrogen atoms and bring them together and you make a bond. If you're talking bonds, you want the energy for the second process, not the overall energy. So you're getting 92.9% of the overall energy, but only 50% of this smaller part, the bit that has to do with the bond. Okay, but still, for such a simple function, that's pretty good. So we weren't bad in taking this linear combination of atomic orbitals to make a molecular orbital. And you see that to get the difference density map, you need high accuracy because it's just as in X-ray difference maps, you needed high accuracy of the calculations and of the experiment. So this very, very crudest model shows more than 50% of what's giving rise to the bond. And what it is a shift of electron density from these negative contours where the electrons are coming away from to the middle where they're building up. They're coming away from the atoms because of that less than 1 over the square root of 2. Right? It's not quite the original atoms, and it's building up in the middle. So there's 0.02 electrons per cubic angstrom there in the middle that wouldn't have been there if it had been just two vanilla atoms. Okay, now, can we do better than this? Well, we could spread the wave function out, right? So that we get more overlap. Now, the atoms aren't going to look as good, right? But the overlap is going to look better. And we could adjust the value of this thing that was 2 here. If we put a bigger thing in the denominator, it will cause the exponential to spread out and get shorter, right? And if that lowers the energy, that's closer to the truth. Because there's a thing, there's a principle called the variational principle that says that the true energy is always lower than anything you can calculate. So the lower you make the energy you're calculating, by whatever trick, whatever honest trick, you can't just divide it by something. If you change the wave function and get a lower average... Now, if you have something that's not the true solution of the Schrödinger equation, the curvature of the wave function won't balance the change in the potential energy as you go from point to point, so you won't always get the same total energy. That's when you got a solution, that no matter where you evaluate it, you get the same total energy. So if you take an approximate wave function, it won't do that, right? But you can get an average energy just the same by finding out what that, quote, total energy is here, 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 here. And the lowest average energy is the best, because that's the true thing. So if you can adjust the shape of your function and get a lower average energy, you're getting closer to the truth. And one simple way to take this model we're talking about of just adding two atoms, one simple way to change its shape is to spread it out by making this denominator bigger. Instead of 2, make it 2.1, make it 2.2, better, 2.3, better, 2.4, still better, 2.5, worse. The best was 2.4. Okay, so that's better than what we had before, right? And now, so we've optimized this exponent by making that 2.4 instead of 2. And now we have something that still isn't a solution, but it's the general spread has increased the bond density. It's now twice larger than what it was before, right? And we now have 73% of the correct bond energy. Right, so we've gotten a lot better. We've gone almost halfway to the truth, which would be 100% of the bond energy. We've gone from about 50% of the bond energy to about 75% of the bond energy just by spreading that function out.
How do you know what percent of the bond energy you have?
You have to have a better calculation that says what it would be when it's true, one of these fancy calculations, or do an experiment that says what the energy is for that. They're spectroscopic experiments. We'll talk about some of them later that allow you to measure this thing. So that's how you know how close you are to the truth. Okay. Now, so by this trick of just spreading the atomic wave functions out, we got within 25% of the true bond energy. Now, can you think of that's a sort of artificial way to make the overlap increase. Can you think of a more realistic way to make orbitals change so they give better overlap? There? Can't hear?
Can you bring the nuclei closer together?
Oh yeah, but we're at the optimum distance now. If you bring them closer, the nuclei repel too much. That doesn't help. It would increase the overlap, absolutely. We'll talk about this a little more later. But it wouldn't help the overall energy. Caitlin?
Maybe account for Z effective.
Account for what?
For Z effective.
That's exactly what we did here. When you change Z effective, you change that exponent. What rho means, which is exactly what broadens it out. So in a sense, that's what we already did. Sinead? Hybridize is a better way to... Remember, that's what, if you put an electric field on, you hybridize the atomic orbitals. Okay, so that's what a 100% 1s orbital looks like, say of the hydrogen on the left. If we want to shift it to the right, we add a little bit of another orbital. For example, there's what happens. I'll back up and go forward again. There's how much we shift the electron density if we put in just 2.7% of 2p. And a little bit of 2s for a reason you'll see. So this will help the AB overlap, but it costs something because we're mixing the 1s low energy electron of a hydrogen with a 2p orbital, which is much higher in energy. So we don't want to put too much of it in, or the atom will start looking crummy. The electrons will be too far from the nucleus. So anyhow, why did I choose 2.7%? Because that turns out to be the optimum value, the one that gives the lowest energy in this variational treatment where you keep modifying until you get the lowest possible energy. So that's what Lipscomb found there, that it looks like that. And now look at how much that's changed the electron density. Right? And now notice there's something neat. instead of coming from on the nuclei to between them, it comes from beyond the nuclei into between them. So you've still got electron as much electron density as before on the nucleus. In fact, a little more than you had before. But it didn't help the energy that much. It helped the bonding density, but it didn't change the bond energy that much. Only 3% improvement by doing this hybridization. And then the last thing they did in this comparison was to do some correlation to keep the electrons apart, this technique called configuration interaction, which I just invoked as a deus ex machina last time. I didn't tell you anything about how it worked. Okay, but they did a little bit of that, and now they got the thing on this bottom set of total and difference density, and now they got 90% of the true bond energy. So they're within 10% of getting the truth with something that's still relatively simple. All it did, they did was hybridize the orbitals a little bit and then do tricks that allowed the electrons to stay apart from one another. So we're practically to the truth with this. So this idea of adding two orbitals in order to get a molecular orbital, adding two atomic orbitals to get a pairwise molecular orbital, is very, very close to the truth. Right? At least in the case of hydrogen. Notice, incidentally, that that's twice better, because the error before was 24%. Now the error is only 10%. It's better than twice improvement in getting to the truth. Okay, however, the density was almost unchanged. We had the correct density at all already, right, with just hybridization. It's just that we didn't have the wave function written in such a way that the electrons would tend to stay apart from one another. So just hybridization and adding the two things together gives a very good picture of what causes a bond. Although, if you want to get values that you're going to plug in to predict equilibrium constants or something like that, and you really care about the value, you're going to have to do configuration interaction and fancy things. But to understand a bond, all you have to do is hybridize two orbitals and overlap them. Okay, so? How can you not change the density and still get so much better? It's because you allow the electrons to stay apart. Okay, so this is our pairwise atomic orbital. Something less than 1 over the square root of 2 as a normalization constant times atomic orbital A and plus atomic orbital on B, and they may be hybridized to give better overlap. Now, what are the virtues of this? It's very easy to formulate and understand, as we've just shown. Okay? It looks like atoms. When you're near A, it looks like A. When you're near B, it looks like B. And remember that that's the main event. When you took electrons off in free space and put them on the nuclei, you got a lot of energy out. Right? That's the big deal. When they come together to form bonds, that's a minor thing. Right? So it looks mostly like the big deal. Okay, that's good. It builds up electron density between the nuclei, which we know to be true from X-ray, and it does it through overlap, which is this source of bonding, that A times B that you get when you square the sum. Okay, it also lowers the kinetic energy as well as building up electron density in between at the expense of electron density that's out beyond the nuclei, builds it up in between. Notice that if you take electron density from on the nuclei and put it between, that's not such a good deal, because when it was on the nucleus, it was very close to the positive charge. When it's in between, it's not close to either, really. Right, but it's not better to be between than to be on a nucleus, but it's better to be between than to be the same distance out here. So this shifting electrons from out here into the middle is definitely a good thing in terms of potential energy. But also it improves this smooths. When you add these two wave functions, you get something that's less curved. We saw that in Erwin meets Goldilocks already, and we've gone through that many times, which lowers the kinetic energy. Although in very tiny print here, I put in a warning that you'll need to consider when you become much more sophisticated and you're in physical chemistry and so on. And there's a thing called the virial theorem. So you can ignore that for now, but it's just so that you won't call me a liar later on. Yeah.
Sorry, going back a few slides, you said the density could remain unchanged, but still have a lower energy because of the correlation.
Yeah. Because you allow the electrons to stay apart from one another. Okay, and hybridizing the atomic orbitals provides flexibility to increase this overlap without hurting the description of the atoms very much. And in fact, you can get any old shape you want by hybridizing orbitals if you're willing to use all of the, mix together all the different orbitals in whatever desired proportion. Okay, but best is to keep it simple. Don't use all the atomic orbitals. Just use the valence level, 2s, 2p, three 2p's and a 2s are what you want to use to make to keep things simple to understand bonding of second row elements. Okay, now we have this and we square it and we get this, and we've seen that that gives things that look like the atoms, but also crucially for bonding this overlap, this product of A times B. And the fact that you get that is why it was less than 1 over square root of 2. And notice, incidentally, if you made the antibond, if you subtracted the two from one another, A minus B, then you get minus this, which means you need something greater than 1 over the square root of 2 here. So it's the opposite in the antibond from what it is in the bond, and that'll come back later on. So bonding depends on overlap and on energy match, which we haven't discussed yet. We'll discuss energy match next time. But now I want to talk a little bit about what determines overlap in the context of carbon-carbon bonds. So consider how the overlap integral, that's this product that we're interested in that's going to create bonding density, the sum of A times B over all space. A is measured from nucleus A, B is measured from nucleus B. At any given point, there's a product AB. And if it's big, that contributes to the overlap. If it's negative, it gives you a small overlap if that product is negative. But anyhow, you sum it up over every place. Some terms positive, some terms negative. It'll depend, obviously, on the distance between two atoms. If they're very, very far apart, there's no place it's big, and the value will be small. If they're real close together, there are lots of places where they have big values. So it'll depend on the distance. It'll also depend on the hybridization, how much 2s and how much 2p you're using in the atomic orbitals that are overlapping. Notice, incidentally, when we did the two hydrogens, we used only 2% of 2p. Why did we use so little? We could have shifted it more and gotten more overlap if we had used more 2p. But you don't want to do it, because in hydrogen, you're starting with 1s and 2p that you're mixing with it is way up here. So it's hurting the description of the energy in the atom to put much 2p with the 1s. But in carbon, it's different, because it's 2s you're mixing with 2p. They're very close to one another in energy, so it's cheap to mix them. Okay, so let's look at this in the context of carbon. Now here's the two 2s orbitals of carbon, and just for scale, I draw the diameter of the node, which turns out to be 0.7 angstroms. You can figure that out with the formulas that we gave you. Okay, so we know what distance is here. If we shift those over to be 0.7 angstroms from each nucleus, and then put the two x's on top of one another by bringing them together, that's about the distance of a carbon-carbon bond. So that's what the two 2s orbitals look like when they're at the distance of a carbon-carbon bond. Okay? Now, how big do you think the overlap integral is? What number should it be? Now, I can tell you something that's going to help you get your mind in the right ballpark for this. If you take the 2s, one of the 2s orbitals and lay it right exactly on top of itself, right? That, and take that overlap, or put these two, one right on top of the other, so all of them give the same value at every place in space. And now I take the product of those, which means I'm squaring the orbital, and sum it up over all space. What am I going to get? One. That's the best you can get, is one. If they are exactly on top of one another. Every place where it's positive, it's positive. Every place where one's negative, the other's negative. So all of them contribute the same way, the same sign to the product. Where they're big, they're big. That helps out. Get a really big number when you square it. So the best you can get is when they're right on top of one another. Now I want you just, because I don't do very well at this, I want you to guess, when they're that far apart, how big do you if the best they could possibly be, when red is right on top of red, blue is right on top of blue, then you get the integral of that product is 1. How much smaller do you think it is now? What do you think that overlap integral would be? Don?
0.05.
You think that that has half as much overlap as having them right on top of one another?
1/20.
Pardon me?
1/20.
Oh, 1/20th, you said. Oh, I thought you said half. I'm with you. I think it should be, well, no, I think it should be bigger than 1/20th. I would say about maybe 1/3, probably less. Anybody else got a guess? Okay, you're the only one willing to guess. Okay? It's 0.4. It's really big. I can't see how that works out, but if you do the integral, it does. Right? So it's pretty big overlap. 40% is big, as if they were right on top of one another. Anyhow, that's a reference point. Now let's make a chart that shows how this varies as we vary the difference, the bond distance. Because here's the distance of a triple bond. So that's how close two carbons would be if they were triple bonded. Here's how close they'd be in a double. Here's how close they'd be in a single bond. And we have this one point here that we already got of 0.41. Now, how is it going to change as we move them? Well, suppose they're very, very, very far apart. How big is the overlap integral? Zero. Okay. Suppose they're right on top of one another. What's the overlap integral? One. So it's going to start at zero and end at one, and this only goes to 1.1 or something like that. So that's out roughly in the hall, or maybe that wall or something, right? So it's going to be 1 there, it's going to be 0 way far out. And this is how it changes, right? So that's the overlap integral if you use 2s orbitals, 2s orbitals to make a bond. That's how big the overlap integral. That would measure how much electron density you're building up in the middle. Okay, how big the bond is. Now, suppose we use an s orbital and a p orbital. And notice, incidentally, I call this p is the name of atomic orbital. In reference to making a bond, I call it a pi orbital. Why call it pi? Because pi is the Greek word for p, for the letter p. In fact, in Greek, you pronounce it p, not pi, but we'll usually call it pi, because that's what people normally do. So that's the molecular orbital analog of p. Why? What is characteristic of a p orbital? It has a nodal plane, right? And this one has a nodal plane that includes the two bonds. See what I mean? So it's sort of the molecular equivalent of a p orbital. And but you call it pi, Greek, because it has to do with a molecule, not with an atom. Okay, now, how big is this overlap integral going to be? Any guesses? Bigger or smaller than S with S? Smaller? Why do you say smaller?
Less overlap.
How much less?
Not much. So, yes, not much.
So maybe 0.2 instead of 0.4?
Sure.
Okay. Look, the product of numbers, the blue is negative, red is positive. It's symmetrical. Someplace on the bottom, it's going to be plus times plus. Someplace on the top, symmetrically related, it's going to be plus times minus. Now what do you think the overlap integral is going to be if you sum up all the different places? How much less? It's going to be zero because you're going to get exact cancellation because of symmetry. Everybody see that? So there's going to be no overlap. Those can't possibly form a bond. They might build up electron density at the bottom, but they depleted at the top, and those effects would cancel each other out. So you're not going to get anything from those. And those have a name. They're called orthogonal. When, by reason of symmetry, you have no net overlap. So don't forget bonding like that. Okay, it won't happen. Now, but suppose we turn the 2p orbital to be such that it doesn't have a plane, a nodal plane that contains the two nuclei of the bond we're talking about. So now it's still a p orbital atomic, but with respect to the molecule or the bond, it's a sigma orbital. It has the same sign top and bottom. Now if we do that, there will be net overlap because blue with blue will be bigger than blue with red. Okay, now what's the overlap going to be when they're really, really, really far apart?
Zero.
How big will the overlap be if they're right on top of one another, the same nucleus?
Zero.
zero because they're going to be orthogonal. There's going to be a plus sign that side that cancels a minus side. Everybody see that? If I put them on the same center. Okay, so it's going to start at zero, but it's going to end at zero too when we get to zero distance. And it's going to look like this. So it's in the region of interest where carbon-carbon bonds are. In fact, it's very similar to the SS. Now I'm going to do two more here and then I'm going to quit. Okay, now, suppose I do P with P, sigma. Okay? Now, what's the overlap at great distance? Zero. How about at zero distance? If they're right on top of one another. If they're right on top of one another, what will it be? No, not one. It's going to be minus one because blue is going to be on top of red. Red's going to be on top of blue. So this curve is going to start at zero and it's going to go to minus one when it gets out to the hall. Right? And it's going to look like that. It's going down toward minus one in the region of interest. And finally, we could look at two p orbitals in overlapping in a pi way. Right? And now what's it going to be at infinite distance? Zero. What's it going to be at zero distance? You got it now. One, and it looks like this, right? Because they don't point the right direction, they don't have as big an overlap as the S with S or the S with P. What I find remarkable about this plot? What I find remarkable is that in the region of single and double bonds, S with P, sigma, is better than either S with S or P with P. Isn't that curious? You'd think that one of them would be better at overlapping, and therefore it would be better at overlapping with itself. But in fact, best is for an S to overlap with P. And it turns out that that has a very interesting implication when we get to the next slide. And that's this curiosity here. And then we're going to go next time to hybridization. Okay. Oh, those who didn't pick up their exams, they're here.
I don't quite understand. What did you mean by positive with negative and negative with positive?
The orbitals have a sign, right. A number and a sign. So if at the same point in space one gives a positive number and the other gives a negative number, the product is going to be negative.
Is that sign?
Let's see. No. Oh, yeah, it is. There we go.
Is that sign determined by displacement?
No, the sign is just the sign of the wave. You know, the wave function has a value. It assigns a number every place in space.
Oh.
We're dealing with wave functions.
Yeah. Okay.
When you have like two p's, and then there's like a blue part down here and red parts down here. So the red's negative and the blue's positive.
Yeah.
And then they overlap.
So red overlaps with red. Every place there you have plus times plus. Every place up here you have minus times minus. But the product is always positive. Cool, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. There you go.
Thank you.
Aviva?
Thank you.